Hi, my name is Dave Reske, founder and president of MouseSpeed, and welcome to this edition of In the Now, where we focus on uncovering myths and misunderstandings of marketing and leadership with some of the world's most interesting people. And my guest today is Glenn Grant. Glenn is an entrepreneur coach and chief visionary at Self-Assembled Ventures. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Excited to be here.
Glenn works with business owners as a coach, building greater business value and world-class leadership teams. He's also started, scaled, and ultimately sold his previous business, G2 Tech Group, to Great Hill Partners. So he's got a lot of experience to share with you. Glenn, as you know, I like to start these conversations with a, what I call a MythBuster question. The question that you and I have been talking about is that most entrepreneurs really want to build their companies to last, but you built your company to sell, or in some ways, you coach other entrepreneurs to also think about building to sell. Should entrepreneurs build to last or build to sell?
Great question, Dave. You know, you asked me that, I started to think about it, and you know what? It's not mutually exclusive by any means. I think it may, you know, not to date anybody here, might be generational. You know, did you read Build to Last first? Did you read Build to Sell first? You know, I read Build to Sell first and then Build to Last second, but I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. And actually, I think that they're overlapping and complementary approaches.
Well, let's unpack it a little bit. So what did, first of all, the Build to Last concept, what is that all about? Like, what are we, as entrepreneurs, what are we thinking about when we think about Built to Last?
So high level, Built to Last is a long-lasting company that's going to, you know, continue on without you, after you, what have you. And I connect that to Built to Sell because companies that are built to sell are also designed to carry on and continue on without you. I'm not the enterprise guy by any means. I'm more the scrappy startup tech company guy. Enterprise is not my jam, but it's all interrelated. And I tend to feel that the Built to Last is the enterprise dream. I want to build the next GE. I want to build the next Ford. I want to build these big companies that are going to go on and on forever. And I just think that the business climate, the ecosystem, has changed, driven by technology. Things change so fast. But I still think it's a very valid platform, right? Apple, they're probably in that Built to Last category for sure. But what do people think of them now? Most of the time, they think phones and then laptops and whatever. When they first started, they were just desktop computers. And I would say they probably sell the least out of all their products, the desktop computer. Laptops, I'm sure they sell a lot, but anyway, it's an enterprise that's evolved over time and it's been built to last. I think one of the core philosophies in the Built to Last saga is that you're essentially building excellent leadership teams and you're also creating a culture backed by your credo or your mission and then also encourage innovation into that mix. So it's a company that's got a great team, great leaders, and you're not resting on your laurels, and you're creating new products and services, and you're allowing to iterate over time. And yeah. I think that is what makes a company last a very long time.
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about that. I want to go back to your example of Apple, because I think that, you know, small business entrepreneurs often are asked to look at examples from big enterprise companies that were built, let's call them built to last. They're asked to look at, hey, how did Microsoft do it? How did Apple do it? How did Tesla do it, right? Those are the examples that often come up in the business press. But, you know, as you pointed out, those companies, it's not often that the small entrepreneur, the founder entrepreneur grows to that level. More often, companies, you know, who are, you know, you're working with or these smaller companies grow and then they sell, right? So, you know, is it fair to really be looking at the examples of Apple and Tesla and Microsoft and those guys as aspirational examples of what we entrepreneurs should be building toward?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily think yes or no, but I mean, something I'll pull out of there is that, you know, those are not privately held companies. So I would argue they were sold. Now, maybe the founding entrepreneur is still there at the helm and maybe, you know, has the largest single shareholder status of 5%, but people didn't invest in your company. It didn't go public because it wasn't built to sell you know, you sold it. You sold a big chunk of it. So you're just still there. You're not selling it and then going off into the sunset. So there's a little splitting hairs there.
Yeah, I think that that actually makes a lot of sense. So what is the concept of build to sell? What are you thinking about when you coach entrepreneurs around that concept?
Yeah, the concept of building to sell is taking the necessary steps in your business, essentially to make it a valuable business that somebody would want to buy. When somebody buys your business, they're really looking at your future stream of profits. I don't want to buy your business if I can't take the money that I spent on your business and make more money on top of that. So that means that profits need to keep flowing. I also have to have some growth potential. You know, I need to be able to take this company to the next level, especially when you're talking about financial investors, you know, private equity. It's a shiny new toy, right? If I can't go out and play with that toy and do fun stuff with it, then why would I want to buy that toy? We want to make money. That's the end game there. But so building the sell is all of the pieces related to having that valuable company. And it's, you know, having a differentiated marketing or market position. So you're not commoditized. You're not competing with other people. It's apples to apples. You can get to apples to oranges. Great. You can set your pricing that way. It's having a leadership team, right? So that the company isn't revolving around the owner. The owner is not involved with everything. And that leads to that long-lasting company as well. Like, I have a team. I could go away for 3 months and the company's going to keep running. You know, I think the revenue model is a big deal. Recurring revenue is my jam. And I recommend everybody who's going to start a business figure out how to make it a recurring revenue business as well. But there's a lot of different factors that make the business valuable. And I think it has just as many benefits when you still own the business versus going to sell it, right? So there's no reason not to build a business to sell just because you don't think you want to sell it one day, or because you want it to be this build the last business, because otherwise it's not a great business to own because it doesn't make money, sucks your will to live. You're working 80 hour weeks. You know, like, you're in the grind. So by building it to sell, you're the next new owner. And wouldn't you want to buy a company that makes a bunch of money and doesn't rely on you holding everybody's hand and getting everything done?
Yeah, very powerful concepts. So where do most entrepreneurs get it wrong on that path? Where do they, you know, and you coach a lot of entrepreneurs. You work with people day in and day out. And in your experience, where do people kind of go wrong on that path in order to build a sell? Because what you described is the kind of company we all want to have, right?
Right.
Great leadership team, differentiated market position. We're able to set our own prices. It's going to be, you know, it's got a brand that people are loyal to, all those things. You know, you might ask an entrepreneur, yeah, that's what I want. But where do they kind of go wrong on that path?
I mean, there's a couple of places to go along. I mean, the first one is recurring revenue, productized service. If you continue, a lot of services businesses, and I work mostly with services businesses, also with some product businesses, and they have similar challenges. But in services, we almost all start off trading dollars for hours, right? If you continue that forever, you're going to tap yourself out on how much you have in stock by how many hours there are in the day and how many people you have on the team. So getting away from that trap is definitely an important thing. But the other big one that is hard to see and is also a painful transition to get out of is the owner being the center of the universe, the owner being maybe all the way up to control freak, maybe just not evolving to that next stage of like, okay, I need to stop doing this. I know it's going to hurt. I know this customer is going to be pissed because they want me because I'm the best and I own it. But if I don't take a step back and work on my business instead of their business by teaching other people to do what I do, I'm never getting out of this trap. And that's the owner's trap. And that is pretty much where I see a lot of my clients and fellow entrepreneurs stuck, or there's kind of various levels of evolution through there. At least I think at least two stages, right? You start a business, you grow a business, you kind of own a job. If you don't get past the I own a job piece and I now want to make it a business I own, you're the one who's billing 48 hours. You're the one who's in charge of all the projects. You're the project manager, you're the account manager, the customer success manager, the bookkeeper, the finance person. It can't scale past you. You can't stay up 24/7. And if you do, you still only have 24 hours a day. So you can't go any more than that.
Wow. Yeah. So, and I'm laughing because I've been there in at least one of my businesses many times. So, as I think probably most entrepreneurs have. So let's talk more about the
think
aim.
we've all been there, right? It's just how quickly we turn that corner. Does it take 10 years or do we do it in like 6 months?
Yeah, because when you first start, you have to do all that. You have to be the salesperson and deliver and be the expert and operations. And you might be sending the invoices and you might be doing all that. But eventually, you're right. You have to let go of those. I call it the taking off hats and kind of distributing that responsibility and letting go and training other people to do that. So, I don't know if it's fair to say most entrepreneurs never really get past that, or maybe. I don't know what the percentage is, you might, but what is keeping them from doing that? Is it the lack, the desire for control? Is it the desire to be in that job? Or is it just what they know and what they're comfortable with and they're happy kind of doing that until they shut it down at the end of when they're at the end of their career?
Great question. I think it's really we don't know what we don't know, right? I would say most entrepreneurs are tradespeople turned business person, and one day they wake up and they're like, "Oh, I'm an entrepreneur." If they wake up, great, we start to do these other things. If not, they own a business, but they might really just own a real big job. So you don't know what you don't know, and that's, Dave, you and I met in the Entrepreneurs Organization. That's where I learned a lot of these things I didn't know. I didn't go to business school, and I'm not really sure they teach that in business school anyway. But it, there's certain humps in the growth of a company and in revenue. Some of it, we refer to this as hitting the ceiling, right? There's the $1 million ceiling, about the $3 million ceiling, and then the next one's between 5 and 7, and it continues on. And really, what you needed to do to get from 0 to 1 million, both in staffing and resources, is different than what you need to put in to get from 1 to 3. So you have to have that sort of wake up moment and be like, oh, wait, I finished season one. I need to now do season two. And it's a different story. And there's different people, right? Most of us start off with a couple of people. And they're unicorns. And it's like I call it the three musketeers, right? There's three of us. It's all for one for all. We're doing everything. You can't grow a company with all unicorns. You can't find them. And if you did find them, it'd be too expensive. And then the dirty little secret is that most of those unicorns we call entrepreneurs. So they're not going to work for you for long because they're going to go start another business. Hopefully not a competing one, right? So you get to that point, and now you have to do things differently. You have to invest in things you didn't have before that you're reluctant to. Like, you might need a project manager, right? I can't do any more projects. I need somebody to be a project manager. But if I hire a project manager, they're only going to be at like 30% capacity based on how many projects and customers we have. So I don't want to invest in it right now because it'll be a waste of money. Well, you can't go any further unless you do invest in it. And then when you do invest in it, you feel like you're wasting money. And I call that little valley behind that first hump, the valley of pain. You have to have a plan to grow through that fast, because if you sit there for too long, you'll drain your resources and exhaust your team and kind of starve the business of cash, right? So you've got to upgrade and invest in the next set of tools and resources and people that you need. But you're going to probably have to save money, a war chest, to make those investments. And that's going to drain if you don't cash in on those investments and get to the next tier, or at least on your way to that next tier. So I think to answer your question more directly, it's that having that wake up moment of, oh, I've got to like up level my game and buy new things and invest in new stuff that I never had before.
So you've kind of been through that whole wave with your company, and you could have seen it, and you've seen it with your other clients. How do you, as a coach, how do you kind of counsel your clients about kind of going through that process? Because it's going to be scary for them to invest in that money losing project manager or that extra accounting person that they don't need until they're 30% bigger, but they don't even know if they're going to get 30% bigger. So there's a lot of risk there. How do you coach them through that process? Is it more emotional support? Is it strategic thinking? Is it differentiated? Is it process? Is it operating system? How do you think about coaching them through those big decision checkpoints to get through those decisions?
So I mean, it's a little bit of all that. I think a lot of it is emotional coaching too. more so experience sharing. Like if I can help people see there's a plan, they can buy into that plan. Not knowing, you just don't know what you don't know, right? So when I start to explain, hey, we're going to get into this valley of pain, we have to get up on through it, they're like, that makes sense. I can save money and I can put aside money for 90 days of a salesperson. And if that salesperson doesn't sell anything new in 90 days, they're gone. But if they do, then it extends that 90 days out and out and out and out, right? So often the conversation starts with sales, anything that's going to help sales or anything that's going to increase your capacity to collect revenue, because we got to feed the machine. So it's something related to that, and that gives people peace of mind. But then I have a whole bunch of coaching mindset things that come into play, all sorts of EO cliches I learned along the way. And one of the biggest ones is you have to get comfortable with people doing what you do only 80% as good as you do it. Usually I get the, no way, unacceptable in my business. My customers will never stand for it. You know, we have our reputation, integrity, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, then you own a job and you're awesome at it. You're a unicorn and your customer's getting unicorn and you're getting maybe paid a little bit more than if you just worked for them. But, you know, you've entrepreneurs are special creatures and we operate at like 100, 125, 150% of what the normal person would be. So what you think is 80% as good as you do is probably about 100% for the average person that's working for you. And you've got to get okay with that. And you've got to adjust your business to accommodate that and to account for that, right? So they're only, so if I have a professional services person, maybe a consultant, I got to get okay with them being a consultant only as 80% as good as I am. Well, maybe that's because they're not as great with the account management piece like I am, because I'm, you know, I like to say entrepreneurs are like Navy SEAL, one man band, we can do anything. So I do need to get a customer success manager who's really good at that piece, who's going to help that person with a piece that they're not good at. But if we have this, you know, single solution mindset where I have to put a person in with this account and they have to be able to do everything as awesome as I can do, you're going to be stuck.
So there's a lot to think about emotionally to kind of help them get over that hump and make those good decisions. So let's come back to that built to sell concept, right? So you talked about a number of things that people have to really think through, that, you know, the differentiated value proposition, maybe their business model around recurring revenue, building a leadership team process. Where do you start usually? What's the most important thing to kind of think about? Maybe in your experience, like order of priority, where do you, and I realize we're generalizing, but what do businesses have to focus on? You know, what are the most important things they have to focus on to get to a point where they're sellable, where they're built to sell?
Yeah, I mean, I always start with the team. You know, when I start working with a customer, I want to map out the team. We use a tool called the responsibility map. I want to see all the players on the field and I want to understand who's doing double duty, triple duty, quadruple duty, and understanding where that is. So understanding the team and who you're going to hire next and all that is certainly where I start. But that's a little bit more into each individual company situation. The next step is really your offering, looking at your offering. We start off doing pretty much everything for everyone. Or everything for that one customer we have, right? It's like, I got my first customer. What do you want? You got it, right? So looking at your offering and through the lens of, I need to stop doing everything for everyone. I need to focus in on a certain set of services or products we do better than anybody else and start to say no to the things outside of that. So when you're going down that path, also what I do is an exercise that, you know, creates a matrix of all the things you do. So in your business, Dave, you're in marketing, and I'm going to make some great generalizations that might be factually incorrect, but just hear me out, right? So you do a lot of things for your customers. We make websites, we write copy, we create brand strategies, we do social media, we do this, we do that. Some of those things are far more teachable and therefore less expensive for you to provide and also more profitable. Some of those things are your special sauce, your claim to fame, the thing that makes customers want to work with you. But generally speaking, they're almost always the most expensive and hardest to find, right? You got your unicorn, and then you've got your newcomers coming into their career and up through the graduation process to maybe become that unicorn one day. So looking at your offering and saying, hey, what can I anchor my offering on that's our special sauce, that's our differentiator, that makes us better than somebody else, and then package these other services around it that you make money on it. So I call that the jelly donut theory, right? So we'll say, for sake of argument, Dave, you're the jelly, right? In your business, right? The jelly is tasty, it's awesome, but it's also kind of the most expensive piece of the donut, but it was what people keep coming back for. Now the bread and the sugar and all the dough around it, that's where you actually make your money. Also with the cup of coffee on the side. So, hey, this high level marketing consulting, you only get so much of this, but you also have to buy the social media management and the other things that I can make money on. But more importantly, I can find people to do that and teach them quickly and they can do it. It takes a lot more time and experience to teach them how to be that jelly. So really reevaluating your offering from that perspective. And then what really leads right into that on the hard business side is the numbers, right? So you do that and then you look at gross profit. How much am I putting in here that's the expensive piece versus how much is less expensive? And then what am I pricing that?
Yeah. Wow. That's a great concept. It feels like, you specialize in services companies, and it does feel like, and I'm a services company, as you've mentioned, digital advertising, it feels like services companies are harder to differentiate because we're doing a service, right? Whereas right. As a product, we can have features, we can have, tangible things that are different. We can make it look different. Exactly. And I'm probably hinting that the grass is greener on the product side.
But it's a lot harder to get started. But what you just said there brings us into the build to last concept, which is you have to have an engine of innovation. And I like to say you want to pivot to your future, not pivot to respond to what's going on. So it's these little pivots, right? I'm making a little pivot to make my business that much different than the rest of the pack, as opposed to waiting for the pack to start to change and me to catch up. So I did that. I had an outsourced IT company for small business. It's early 2000s. So we're just still fixing printers and Exchange servers and desktops and laptops and helping the end user. And to make a long story short, what I did is I started to pivot my service offering to this thing called the cloud on Amazon Web Services. I'm still doing IT, but I'm a little bit different. And then I pivoted a little bit more to really support SaaS companies with managed DevOps. I'm still an IT company. I'm not a law firm, but there's, 25 small business outsourced IT providers in Boston in a stone's throw from my window. But now I'm the only one who does this specialization on the Amazon cloud and now is working with the software developers deploying their stacks on the cloud with DevOps. And then the rest of the industry started to catch on to that. And then I have to come up with the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on that, when you were making that transition, that pivot, let's talk about the pivot because that's really important here, did you let go of everything you were doing in the past and do that pivot all at once? Did you do it slowly to maintain revenue and profitability? Or did you one day wake up and say, we're not going to fix any printers anymore. We're only going to do DevOps. Stop and move over to the thing. How do those pivots work in reality with your business and in reality with your clients?
So for the most part, slowly. I will admit, I did come in to the office after reading Built to Sell and immediately said, dude, we're not doing websites anymore. Dave and his industry can do that. I don't want to do that anymore because it's so different than what we're doing. So we stopped doing stuff that was like way on the fringe. But no, it's very important to not drop everything and only start doing the new thing because you don't know if it works yet, right? You don't know what's behind that door till you open it. So we created a new offering. We started to sell it in the marketplace when the opportunity seemed right. So we kind of transitioned. There were some accounts where we engaged with and I'm like, these guys are a little high maintenance or whatever. I'm only going to sell them when I know whether it works right now. I'm not going to experiment on them because I don't know what's going to happen. Right. So we sold a couple times and then we had both types of opportunities come in, continue to sell. But really, when we hit a point where 50% of our recurring revenue was on the new model, we stopped selling the old model. So it was a transition over time, but there definitely was that come in. And if you're still doing everything for everyone, getting real with yourself and being like, I'm not doing this. Like, websites were first. Like, we're techies, right? So we make websites, we make them look pretty, blah, blah, blah. And then it would be full of lorem ipsum. Because what I don't have is the consulting part to sit down with the customer and say, what is your message? What are you trying to say? I'm like, I didn't even realize that was a thing until I started doing it. And then I'm trapped in these website projects that never end because I can't help the customer actually articulate their value proposition. I got to stop doing that.
Yeah. So kind of a core part of being built to sell is creating that really important differentiated service offering that that is easy to sell over and over again, that you become the best in the world at, and that you make higher margins at, and then you really grow based on that strategy. Is that a kind of a core, the strategic thinking you've got to
that
get?
Is it. A book that I read early on. So the first two books I ever read when I, you know, became an entrepreneur, one was Built to Sell, big fan, John Warlow. Second one was Blue Ocean Strategy. Mm-hmm. And that is really around that creating that differentiated marketing position. And that was my aha moment, where the blue ocean is where the water is clear and you're swimming by yourself. The red ocean is where your competition, the sharks are, and there's a ton of blood in the water. And if you can come up with something just a little different and swim away, you've got less people trying to poach your customers, and you have a much clearer value proposition when you're in the sales process, because there's no other oranges for people to compare you to.
Wow. Powerful concepts, Glenn. This has been a great conversation. You're clearly really good at this, and I'm sure you're helping many clients think through their businesses, grow, and be ready to sell or build to last or whatever they want to do long term. So, it's big ideas, and I appreciate your insight. If people want to get in touch with you, learn more about your services and how they can work with you, how would they do that?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn for sure. Glenn Grant, Self-Assembled Ventures. And then also send me an email, glenn.grant@selfassembled.com.
Great. Well, Glenn, thanks for the conversation today. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot, and it was challenging, and I'm going to take all this and hopefully be built to sell myself one day.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for having me. Great conversation, and great to see you.
Great. Thanks, Glenn. Take care.